Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of season 2 of Dickinson Forevermore podcast. I am one third of your podcast host, Robin Detman. I'm a director and producer at LDW Films, and I'm the producer nerd on this podcast.
Hi, I'm Jess. I am a writer, actor, and the resident editing nerd of this podcast.
Hi, I'm Jay Red. I'm a photographer, I'm a music producer, and like my queen, Emily Dickinson, says, I dwell in possibilities.
In this week's podcast, we're going to do a deep dive into Dickinson Season 1, Episode 9, Faith is a Fine Invention, and it's going to lead us into the finale, Episode 10, I Felt a Funeral in My Brain. We're going to discuss so many wonderful character and story arcs that really take hold in these two episodes, the threads, the seeds that are planted that are really going to carry us through Season 2 and all the way through the entire show. After our break, we're going to do a recap of the fabulous Ella Hunt weekend that was kicked off by some wonderful fan engagement courtesy of Gold Rush Events. Ella did a full day event on Saturday, March 19th. We were there for trivia, so we'll share a little bit about that. And then we're going to end with a discussion about the beginning of award season. Emmys aren't upon us yet, but we're getting close. And we're going to talk about all the magic that we're seeing in detail in front and behind the camera. You know, all the things that we hope get its due this year. You know, awards aren't everything, but we want this show that's made us feel so seen and loved and inspired us, so many of us, in our own lives, in our own work. We want it to live on. We want it to be part of the canon and hashtag Dickinson box set. Okay, so one of the things that really struck me during this episode was my own interpretation of faith. So obviously it starts off and we are in a church, and that is one kind of faith that people talk about a lot, right? Which is organized religion and in relationship to that. But then the definition of faith is complete trust or confidence in something or someone or something. And as I was watching it for the second time during the rewatch, I just kept thinking of like what different kinds of threads of faith are we seeing in the episode, especially in relation with Emily, but then some universal things. One of the things that first came to my mind was faith in people and how that can be eroded and how much faith that we put in people. Like Emily knows Ben is really sick. And I kept wondering, does she really know how sick he is? I mean, the beginning of the episode, it's like death is everywhere. And we had talked about how in those times, death was everywhere. If you got really sick, you were done, you know? So I was just wondering, I'm like, well, how much faith is Emily putting in that she can sing him out of it, that she can love him out of dying? And how many times do we do that in real life? You know, like maybe not dying, but almost feel like we can have a control over death, which is another thing I think Emily has faith in that I really wanted to talk to you both about was like, when she goes to see death, what faith is she bringing into that? Is it like, does she have faith in her power of that relationship? Like he even says, this isn't a relationship, you know? This is like, you're looking at it like it's a love relationship and it's not, nobody understands me. Before that, she thinks he's jealous. And then she literally gets on her knees and starts undoing his pants, which is a very, very bold choice. So I was like, what kind of faith do you have in a relationship that you can literally have death stop? And so Jess, I wanted to ask you, I know a lot about, or you had talked about like Emily's relationship to death and how sometimes that resonated with you in different ways in her poetry, right?
Yeah. Well, firstly, in correlation to how this is perceived through the lens of like Emily and then her seeing the situation with Ben, or as you said, she might possibly be ignoring it. Maybe, you know, just ignoring the bigger signs, the bigger red flags that would stand out to anyone else. But considering that she takes it upon herself to take care of him, I feel like she knows. But I think she idolizes both death and Ben in the same kind of way.
Really?
Yeah.
Go deeper for me, because
yeah, how would you,
what do you mean by idolize Ben? I can see idolizing death because we see it in her poetry, but what do you mean by idolizing Ben?
Well, Ben represents a potential future that Emily might be alive long enough to see, which is that there doesn't have to be this predisposed like heteronormative idea of what the household in general should look like, or marriage in general should look like. So I feel like he represents that possible future, and she idolizes the idea that men could support women in what they want to do, which is what he does for her.
Oh, and you think she idolizes him for that?
I feel like she's at that crossroads between feeling like she might be falling in love with someone.
But I think she's falling in love with the idea of him, yes, though. Or I think she fell in love with the idea of Ben, of the commodity that she could find. You know, she also wanted an escape, a way out from, you know, the foot of her father, basically.
Yes.
So, I mean, I think she just, like, was in love with the idea of that comfort that would bring her.
Yeah.
Well, and Ben also represents a possibility, as where death represents the inevitable. And I feel like with Emily's relationship to death, I feel like, as you said, she might have thought she was in more control than she thought. You know, she thinks essentially sometimes that she summons him when she needs that escape, that she summons death, but he doesn't always come at her command. He kind of appears at different points in her life where it's unexpected for her.
Yeah, that is so true. I never thought about that. I never looked at it that way, but it's so true, because when she talks about death earlier in the season, it's almost like she's an equal. And then, yeah, it's like a relationship, and that he's coming to her. Yeah. All right, I see that.
And then after that, I mean, scene, we see him just kind of like really willy-nilly just do what he wants. Like, we see that you know, there was no control.
What do you mean,
for Emily there? Well, no, like Emily always felt like she had this like command of him, right? And like after that scene, we see there is really no, you know, they're not equals, or she's not above him. You know, he doesn't move or bend to her. It's after that scene, I feel like we see sort of like a mentorship in a way with Death and Emily.
Mentorship. That is an interesting.
Well, yeah. I mean, every time after that, we see her, every time we see her hop in the carriage, there's always like this little piece of advice or this little bit of enlightenment that he gives her.
Until the end. When he asked until her, the very end, so positive. Or actually, I guess in season
whenever one. The wardrobe. Yeah, the wardrobe.
Oh, so interesting. It just struck me that, and this is gonna thread into something we're gonna talk about later with Emily and Sue, is that I feel like, again, we're starting to see Emily realize she has to look outside the way that she's always looked at the world, right? And when you're young, the world is what you make of it all the time, right? Or at least I went through this experience. And then all of a sudden, when I was 25, I was like, what? It's like, this is not my music video. Like, I'm not in control, or I don't know everything. So it's really interesting to start to see her have to deal with the reality of the world around her. You know what I mean? Which, again, in season 3, becomes a question about work, about how can you do the kind of profound work that she does if you're completely shutting out the world. So another interesting thing that I found was everything about Mount Holyoke when she's talking to Maggie. So that is completely true. That happened. Emily did go to Mount Holyoke, and the whole thing with people standing up and saying that they see God or they accept God now, and she never did, because the truth was she never found God the way that they were expecting her to. So I thought that was interesting, that was something that was literally put in there, and a really interesting point about Emily, which leads me to another thing about faith, is that I feel like part of Emily's church, if you will, is nature always, and that she puts her faith in nature all the time. I don't think that ever changes. I don't think that faith is ever rocked.
I mean, yeah, we see it in her poetry time and time again, the amount of poems that are connected to poetry. And then the amount of poems where you see that she's struggling with her faith. Like, you can see it's a battle for her. Like, she, it's not that she didn't try to find God, right? We can see it in the poetry, but I just don't think she ever made that connection.
Well, no, and her whole family did, including Sue, including Austin, right? That was the last thing that Austin, I don't want to say that's the straw that created the marriage, but like in real life, like her whole family. But I did read that note that Emily was one of the only people in that in that little circle of family.
Yeah, she never became a member of the church.
No.
For a second, I'd like to go back to what you said, Robin, about Emily viewing nature as essentially it being a church for her. So with Emily, I feel like with nature and death, I feel like both of those things are the only things that she sees as resolute. The only two things that will never change. And that's why she's holding on to them so deeply, like when she writes, and she's a little bit further away from that faith and you know, their version of God, you know, essentially. She believes in science more than she believes in.
I wouldn't say science per se, but I mean, because like attaching nature directly to science and that belief is I think a stretch, but I think she believes in what she can. I mean, she sees that nature, you know, changes with the seasons, but it's never failing, right? Like it always happens, and death always happens, you know. Death is inevitable, just like nature is. Nature will run its course. So I think it's more so faith that is contextualized, like she can see it and it's inevitable, whereas faith via religion, you can't really see it.
Yeah,
I mean, some people say they can feel it, right? But is
wouldn't you think that Emily would consider that faith in God a variable? Because if nature and death are the backdrop, or love even, the backdrop to most of her poetry, then God would be a variable because she doesn't understand it and she has no proof of existence.
Should it be? I mean, I wouldn't attach all of that together, like love, death, nature. What does that have to do with God? I don't know. Ooh. Like I wouldn't connect
in relation to it's been said that God created all of that.
Well, yeah, that is a belief, right? But I think in, like, if we were to see through the scope of Emily's eyes, right?
Mm-hmm.
For her, I don't think that faith was contextualized. Like, if you, I guess, wanted to attach it to science, like you had stated earlier, love is a chemical reaction, right? If we're going that deep. I don't know. I just think it's for her, I just don't think those lines ever, like, connected. Like, I feel love, it is godly. I feel that nature is beautiful, it is godly. I don't think those lines ever connected for her.
Hard to say.
And it's really hard to say.
Hard to say.
Yeah.
Well, the two things came into my mind is, like, one, for me, nature and something bigger than all of us is completely connected. And again, we're not going to deep dive into each other's faith and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of based on Taoism. So they're very connected, but I don't attach the word God to it. So that came up for me, Jay, was like, for me, it is all connected. Like what I feel that other people might call God is in love, is in nature, is in all that. But again, it's personal. It's people's relationship.
Yeah.
Right?
I connect deeply with the universe. Like I feel like every little thing, whether it be manifestation, whether it be anything, you guys see me holding a crystal in my hand right now. Like it's really like everything is connected. And I feel like nature moves the way, you know, it's supposed to, the way the universe has it set up to be, whether God created that universe or didn't, like that is not on me. I'm going to die one day and we'll probably figure it out.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, totally. Well, yeah, totally. So, for you and I, it does actually connect, right? But who knows, right? Again, and it's, I think
who knows,
it's really
through
subjective.
Emily, I mean, yeah, mm-hmm. We could dive deep into these poems of hers and never know the answer.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that we can guess, but like, that's the beauty of it. The other thing I wanted to touch on was what you said, Jess, that both nature and death are resolute. And it made me think of Jurassic Park, where nature will find a way, which also reminds me when I'm walking down the street and you see concrete and you see this little like plant that's like, fuck it, I am gonna grow right here. It's like it's
alive out of spite.
It finds a way, and until we extinguish the earth, it will always find a way. So I just want to say that that really resonated with me of why. Yeah. And I just have to say, I have to call back again with Faith. I love Maggie so much because I think she said something that I think of sometimes when people will use something like religion or politics or something to be able to perpetrate hate or something that would seem unfaithy, I guess.
Unholy
when she said that the mistress must have had a flea up her arse. I thought that was perfect. And then Emily turns around and says, you can never leave. And I thought that made me think about the fact that Maggie didn't leave, right? She was there. So,
or also the thing that Maggie said when she looked at Emily and she was like, maybe you just haven't found the right faith. And that didn't tie it to religion, a God, an entity, anything. She just said, maybe you just haven't found the right faith. You know, faith can quite literally mean anything and everything.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, Ben, speaking of faith, where Ben, before they unpropose, he was talking about George and he made that remark about you kicked him out of the Garden of Love. I thought that was really interesting because to me, I thought that was like kind of a biblical reference, even though.
The Garden of Eden?
She's
like, I never said he could enter the Garden of Love.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yes, but have you read the Garden of Love?
No,
neither
have I read the Bible, so
it's very morbid.
It is very morbid. And it's very like prophesizing. I feel it's by William Blake. It's The Garden of Love is the poem.
Oh, yeah, and then the fact that they read that out loud to each other, or like stated it out loud to each other right before he was about to die, like that was top tier, Elena Smith.
Yep.
The whole episode was just, I think, again, we'll go on to our next point, but like brilliantly written and gorgeously shot. My God, the color grading that they do whenever Death comes in, the editing when she walks out of Ben's door and we cut and she's in that gorgeous dress. And like, again, Tim Orr, DP. I really want him to get an Emmy. And then, yes, the eclipse, I thought, was
that
just
whole,
a beautiful montage. Yeah. And again, nature, right? What an amazing event. We talked about that. What an amazing event back then. Like, they didn't have the Hubble telescope. They didn't have what we have today. So imagine what a huge thing that was to see midnight at noon. So, okay. So Jess, talk to us, parents.
About parents.
About the parental units.
Okay, well, there is a line that's stated in episode 9 that I feel is underrated. Now, it might have stood out for others like it did for me, but most definitely that line is when Miss Dickinson says to Emily, don't bring Death into this house. And Emily says, what difference does it make to you? You're dead inside already.
Yes.
That in and of itself should be telling of what the relationship is. I mean, we get a glimpse of what their relationship is, but we don't see it on like the daily kind of. You know what I mean? Like we see them throughout time, but not where they have to coexist every single day.
Not since the beginning, right? In the first episode, right. We see that.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, it's more about her and her dad.
That
line, like the second rewatch, I was like, how did that not land on me the same way?
Yeah.
It's brutal, right?
I didn't catch that the first time I watched the episode, and then I watched it again earlier today, and then it was like, I was like, whoa.
Whoa. Exactly. Talk about dropping a bomb. I was like, damn.
It also made me think about something that I tell Jess all the time. Mrs. Dickinson is always in despair. Like,
yeah, she is
always in despair. It's like every single, like, I didn't realize this. Like, I remember thinking in season 3, I was like, why is she always going through it? Like, what is up with her, right? And then now I'm looking at every single episode since season 1, and then we're going into season 2. I'm like, you know what? This woman was always in despair.
abject bottomless despair. Yeah.
Always eating that chocolate cake.
Yeah. No. Stress eating.
Totally. Yeah, and we're going to see more of that.
The belladonna drops had me on the floor.
Oh, her again, top comedy, right? I mean, the comedy timing of Jane is just so brilliant. And of course, it reminded me of Botox, right? Because people are like, and I know that Botox actually now is used for a lot of people that have migraines, which is an amazing breakthrough. But like that whole thing of like something that you use beauty that's like, yeah, it's slightly poisonous.
Really makes
I'm just gonna inject this dots. So I can't move my forehead.
It just really makes me connect the dots though, that like she was a hazard to herself. Like she was over here crashing into tables, was about
setting
to
herself on fire while she's talking about the curse.
She had, like the knife, and she was about to put the knife into her mouth. Like it was just like they had to really take care of her like a child.
Well, foreshadow. But Jess, are we getting away from?
I mean, yeah, I feel like it definitely ties in because she had to have everybody take care of her, take shifts, essentially, because, I mean, the whole house had to take care of her. But to speaking to the, like, darker side of this codependency, mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of what Mrs. Dickinson projects onto Emily is all the things that she did not want at Emily's age, like, because in season three, right, we get more of a backstory, right, with Mrs. Dickinson. And she talks mm-hmm. about how she wasn't ready to get married. She didn't want to be a mother. She didn't want any of that.
Yeah.
And she projects all that onto Emily and tries to force that on her, even though her father says she doesn't have to marry if she doesn't want to.
Well, she probably resents her, right? So I think that is something, have we touched on that, where there's sometimes a mother-daughter thing where there's a lot of resentment because the daughter usually
always a competition.
Have more freedom. Well, yeah, but I mean, in a very practical sense, a daughter sometimes, and again, it depends on the culture and the country and everything else, but most of the time there's evolution and there's more freedom. So imagine feeling somebody that was forced into something and now you have a daughter who your husband's like, yeah, you don't have to get married. You don't have to, you know, like... that kind of natural resentment comes up and she doesn't handle it very well, I think, but.
Which kind of makes me cringe though, because whenever, I think, was it the end of episode 10, if we can connect these dots, the end of episode 10, Mr. Dickinson goes and knocks on Emily's door and he's like, it's just you and me. It's just you and me. And it's like, it just throws me back to when Mrs. Dickinson was like, you just want her all to yourself.
So we've talked about this. Edward's character borders, there's cringe there for me. And it's mm-hmm. not just the physical abuse, but like the manipulation. And I know we said that Emily has her way too, but that whole thing where he emotionally abuses her in front of everybody and then crawls into her bed, like he's, again, Stockholm syndrome, et cetera. But like, yeah, there's some
those parents are, oof.
Well, and also in that moment, when he goes to knock on her door, he's not there to make her feel better. He's not there to comfort her. He's there seeking refuge. No, because earlier in the episode, when Mrs. Dickinson is reading his letter from Washington, he's scared out of his mind because a man drew a weapon on the congressroom floor.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's why she's stress eating. That's why she's freaking out. Fast forward to this moment. He knocked on her door seeking asylum with her. He was there to comfort himself, to remind himself, yep, this is why I need to stay home. So he was trying to validate his own reasons. So instead of admitting that he's scared, he'd rather come home with his tail between his legs and pretend like everything's fine and then be like, but I have a house full of women I need to attend to. Especially my daughter, Emily.
Yeah.
That, but I also want to connect this back to whenever he was about to leave and she was like, well, when you come back, I might not be here. Where would you go? Right. And then this is the first thing he says when that door opens, he's like, I'm here. I'm back.
Everything's going to be okay. Cause I'm here now. And Austin, what does Austin say?
Father of the Year award.
We start to see him, right? That's one of the first times we really see him push back on his dad, or at least just push a little reality out there about like, oh, great, everything's fine because you're here now.
That's so crazy. The first time I watched this, like, I remember seeing season three and I'm like, yes, all this resentment and all this rage. But then like now I see it on this on the final episode where he like pushes back to Mr. Dickinson and I'm like, whoa.
Yeah. Those threads, right? That's what's that's what's been so cool about this rewatch. All right. Lavinia.
Miss Vinny.
Let's talk
Miss Vinny Queen. Miss Queen of taking her ownership back of herself. Yes. Yes. I freaking love Vinny, first and foremost. After the church scene, after all that mumbo jumbo goes down, we catch Vinny talking to Mr. Cringe Joseph, all right? And she is giving a nude self-portrait of herself to Joseph, saying, I want you to, you're the only person I want to gaze upon my body. And he goes, I'm gonna do more than just gaze upon that body, girl, okay? And I just cringe and my soul left my body and I was like, this is not it. And I'm just like, Vinny, girl, what are you doing, right? And we have this moment of, Vinny, girl, why are you giving this man a new picture of yourself, right? And then we get to the point where she is entering, what is this, like a, I don't know if you guys have seen like those paint with me classes, right?
Oh, no, I think it's just an art class, right? Where you're drawing something.
Yeah, and they were talking about a pheasant and this pheasant's bust. And then Toshiaki's like, yeah, and they're busting their ass. And this pheasant's so thick. And then Vinny's confused. Come to find out, whole time, they're talking about her nude portrait that Joseph showed to the entire freaking city. And you just see this like wave of like hurt go through her, right? Like the slut shaming was real, guys.
Yeah. Nothing and like blaming the victim.
I just hate it. Like I hated that entire, I didn't hate the scene. I thought the scene was incredible, but I hated how that scene made me feel.
Yeah.
Because like we see that even today.
Oh, we like, especially see it today with social media and with those parallels of like victim blaming of like, why would you do that? Like somebody who maybe shared a partial nude or whatever with their lover. And it's like, why would you do that? And it was like, how is that your business? It's always blaming the victim. It's never blaming the person who happened to show it around town. And they don't do that either. It's disgusting.
And if a guy does it, then it's not.
No, it's always blaming the girl and saying, how could you do that? Why would you do that? And it's like,
and so she
talking
says,
about Joseph Lyman, although I guess they all say we all know.
Well, they did. They said he was a creep, right? Yeah. But even then, they only shunned him momentarily. They said, why would you do that? Joseph's a creep.
They were part of it. But then
they immediately deflected it back to Vinny. And Toshiaki says, yeah, Vinny, haven't you ever heard of modesty? Like,
victim blaming. And also, they're as bad as him. They are as bad as him because they are taking that and using it to hurt somebody. So that's just as bad as showing a nude picture, in my opinion.
But I love Vinny, and I love the transition that she has. You see at the end of episode 9, she is, you can still see that wave of hurt over her, right? And as she's looking at her sketchbook with all those nude self-portraits of herself, and she's sitting in front of the fire, she's thinking of burning all of those pictures. And instead what she does is she goes and takes full ownership of herself and full ownership of her nude self-portraits, and like a true queen today would own it and quote unquote post it on social media or whatever, right? Or own up to it. And she went to go put each picture on a little in front of the canvases.
Go Vinny. She claimed it.
But also to take ownership, not just of herself or her self-worth. We see in episode 10 that Joseph comes back with his tail between his legs. And he's like, look, I'm so sorry. I messed up. And he tries to give her a locket to quote unquote lock it down. And she goes, no. I can't. I got to take care of my cats. Priorities.
Yeah, end of season 2, right? What a great arc she had just in that entire season. We see her start, like her evolution, that we end up seeing the result of this later with art, with her expressiveness and with her saying no, right? Go Vinny! Also, I have to say, I did think about the parallel of Vinny sitting in front of the fire with Emily's poems later and in real life and being like,
no,
maybe not. I don't know. I would imagine that might have come up while they were.
Now that we're talking of Emily's poems, and I wanted to touch on that relationship. We did touch on it a little bit earlier with her and Maggie. We see Emily at the end of episode 10 sewing together those fascicles, right?
Yep.
That is actually something that Maggie helped her do.
Mm-hmm.
So that to me was just a brilliant little, I would have loved to see Maggie and Emily doing it together. But it was still really nice to see that.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's still one of my favorite books of Emily's. I think it's Miller did a version where it's all the fascicles. So the poems are not in chronological order the way a lot of people do them. They're in the order of the fascicles, which I love because I love seeing whatever Emily put together, right?
Like the way she intended.
These poems belong together. Although, like I said, I was really bummed when somebody remarked they changed them. Like they moved dashes, which I found really odd because they were trying to be so authentic. But yeah, the fascicles. So we're at the wedding. So in real life, which I found so interesting, none of the Dickinsons were at Austin and Sue's wedding in Geneva. None of them. And there's this quote I wanted to share, which I thought was really interesting. It was from a letter that Sue had, and now I have to try to find where it is.
Dramatic gay gasp. They were not at the wedding?
No. So apparently there was a big to-do. So Sue wrote to, I think, her sister that there was a great shaking among the old plans and thawing of fancy frostworks.
It's like, the wording.
What? What is happening? But yeah, they skip off to Geneva and get married. No Dickinson's there. So I thought that was super fascinating. And of course it makes sense.
So bold.
If you're doing a reinterpretation or a revisionist look at it, it makes much more sense, obviously, to place it in the home and then be able to dig into some more family dynamics and character dynamics. But I just thought that was interesting. Yeah. I did love the beginning in the, you know, those intros that they do, the title mm-hmm. scenes. Where I didn't notice this till the rewatch, where the bride is being taken away by a bird.
Yeah. Or the falcon. It's the falcon. No, it was a falcon. It was a falcon.
From the falconer.
Yeah. Who made out with Vinny.
Again. Those were all so good. One of the things that, you know, at the end of a season, right, I feel like we're seeing these arcs. We're seeing the beginning of something that's going to thread to season 3, right? I feel like we're starting to see that really with Mrs. Dickinson. We're starting to see relationships and where they're going to end up and then the character arcs. And one of the things that really struck me and one of the things I've been talking about is Emily not being able to see outside her own boat, right? She's out with lanterns looking for herself, but she's just kind of looking in her boat most of the time, right? And looking at things through what she can see. And I feel like with Sue, when she says to Sue, I never understood how much pain and how much you've had to carry. I feel like that's really one of the first times that we hear Emily see someone and their experience and not in relation to her. So I thought that was a beautiful end to the season and a great part of the character arc.
I think that also ties into what you were saying earlier about Emily finally kind of being able to see past her own privilege, I guess. It's like she's finally like connecting with people outside of her own like little world or bubble.
Well, yeah, and it leads to like season 3. It leads to like when it comes to the, you know, the idea about an artist, you know, that Betty brings up, that you can't like what art are you going to create? What good are you going to put out in the world if you're ignoring the world? If you're not interacting in some way or experiencing it in some way, like how can you be this hope that you want to be? And we hear that more in season 3. And so I think it's so important for Emily to have to bust through that and see other people around her, not just her experience of the world. You know, it's like without that, I can't imagine that Emily Dickinson, or without that or a version in real life, I can't imagine that Emily Dickinson could do what she did and make this kind of art and these poems that just resonate hundreds of years later on such a universal level. So that line really stuck out to me. The one about the pain just makes me stronger.
Why did Kelly Clarkson just come into my head? Just her song, What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Stronger. There's a whole song.
I feel like, and we did talk a little bit about this before we started recording, is that like, there's truth in that, right? If you overcome something, if you have to get through grief, you go through a lot, right? you go through a lot of phases and a lot of emotional growth most of the time. I just feel like that is sometimes that's used as like, it's only part of the story, and that you still have to go through the grief and you still have to feel everything. And Jay, you had said, it's the beginning of seeing Sue, it's planting the seed of how Sue is going to start to stuff stuff down in season two, is that she has that belief of like, I just have to get through. I just have to get through. And it tied in for me how Sue has not been proactive at all in her life. She hasn't been the active person. She's been reacting to what life has been giving her. And I think she's going to start doing it in season two, but I feel like that's also part of it, of like, it just accepting that. I don't know how you guys feel about
that. Well, yeah, it's just like I said earlier, it's just like having to go through all this stuff for character development is, it just, you know, Sue had a lot of character development.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of that development, I mean, in this particular scene that you were talking about, Robin, where Emily is seeing Sue really for the first time that we're aware of, you know, and to me, it felt like Sue's breakdown in that moment was met with her simultaneous need for Emily, because Emily walks through the door at the exact moment that Sue needs her most, right?
You see this big sigh of relief. You can see she's going through it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, and Emily even says to Sue, you're, you know, right next door and a whole world away. That's another profound statement that left an impact that kind of resonated throughout each
season. And you also see it whenever Sue's like, when they're about to tie the knot, you just see Sue constantly looking up towards Emily's room.
Yeah, like she didn't buy it, Austin.
Yeah, no, she knew.
Which, and there you go. Now we also see this little streak in Austin too, where he uses his privilege and he shuts her away basically and tries to gaslight everybody. And it's like a little,
it's a little tantrum.
Like a little temper tantrum. Yeah, like it's going to make everything go away. Like they're not going to love each other because you're going to be stuck up in a room, which honestly probably connected them in some ways more. So.
Yeah, and even Emily says to Austin, just because you're a man doesn't mean you have to become a monster.
Yes. Oh my gosh, that's right.
I mean, and in actuality, he made her lock herself away. He didn't lock her away, because we later see that her dad goes and knocks on her door, right? And she opens the door.
She opens it.
But even Austin told her, you're going to go up to your room. You're going to lock yourself away. He told her what she was going to do. And that's what prompted her to say all of that. But still, you know, and as we said before, he was sus even back then. So he didn't want them together at all.
You know what I thought was interesting was, I remember when I first saw the small writing, and Emily's like, yeah, I did that on purpose. I never thought that maybe that was a real thing, but it was. There's a picture of, it wasn't that poem, but there was a picture of a poem that she wrote that's like so tiny, like you would have to use a magnifying glass. So I thought that was just interesting of like, oh, Emily did do that.
We got to find out what that poem was, so that way we can be like, who did she write it to? Why didn't she want people to see it?
Well, and also when she gave Sue that poem, right, and it has the little tiny envelope, if you look on the outside of it, it has the roses. But in the previous episodes, right, where Austin enters the poetry contest for Emily,
yeah,
that, you know, Sue was the little rose that was intended for that poem. So I mean, I'm just saying,
going back to like the little magnifying, having to use a magnifying glass to read that poem, imagine getting that poem. I don't know if it's like, and you don't have a magnifying glass like available, like just like, no, just imagine. Have you ever, gotten like a big old long paragraph text message and you're like, I'm not reading that. Could you imagine getting that poem and being like, I'm not reading that?
I think it's a lifeline for Sue. I mean, I think that it's kind of mirrors when she was at the rapist house, you know, and Emily's this lifeline. And then Sue even says, I don't know if I can do this, right? It's probably all hitting her. And now she's, you know, she knows she's pregnant, and then I feel like that letter is like, it's her lifeline, you know? And I kind of feel like they had a little bit of a little Emmy Sue marriage. Like, I just feel like they had a little ceremony on their own when they went out running around and playing and stuff. And there was just sort of this kind of cementing of their love in an unspoken way.
They get married lots of times.
in the show. Yeah, yeah. But I mean, like, for Sue to forget, like, so Sue to get her dress dirty after they spent a lot of money, like, she's just present with the person that she really loves. And it's like this little lifeline. But it's also part of the other thing that's like, you're
right next door and a whole world away.
So I feel like all these things are kind of being set up in this end scene, is that you're seeing this connection and then the distance that's going to happen. You know, another thing about the scene between Sue and Emily is when Sue says, "I hate the fact that I'm not doing this with you." And on this rewatch, it just struck me of how this is going to play out later. The marriage part with their spiritual marriage, and then, you know, with little Ned. So I thought that was a really beautiful moment. And, you know, on this rewatch, these moments are even more beautiful because then you know where they're going to end up. So, so good. And that sets us up for season two.
Ba-ding, ba-ding.
We're not going to talk about now. Ba-dum, ba-dum. Let's, shall we segue and revisit and talk about how cool Ella Hunt Weekend was.
It was so awesome.
That's all the love that was being put out over the weekend.
Oh my god, it was so incredible.
All right.
Gold Rush Events hosting Gold Rush Weekend this past Saturday.
Huzzah.
It was lit.
We were at the Q&A.
We were at the Q&A.
They did a fabulous job.
Yeah, they absolutely did.
Yeah, I think that's a lot of logistics. We talked a little bit about it. Done virtual events before. That is a lot to do. That's a lot of people to wrangle with waiting rooms and, you know, keeping your guest star, you know, happy and engaged. And I can't believe how long it went on.
Like, yeah.
I was just in the Q&A and then regretting later that I didn't do anything else. But I was watching Twitter, right? I was looking at all the reactions and all the love and all the everybody talking. And I didn't realize that Ella's part went all the way. I mean, it was hours that she was doing this with little breaks in between, but like, what a
shout
great
out
thing.
To the bugs. What a great shout thing. Out to the bugs.
Shout out to the bugs.
And shout out to all the women on the Gold Rush team. You ladies are incredible. Yeah. Now, some of y'all were running on no sleep. Some of y'all were running on little food, just a little snack here and there. Look, y'all did the damn thing, okay? So shout out to you ladies.
Yeah. And shout out to all the fans that got to meet Ella. And also shout out for sharing little nuggets, little cool things. There were so many different things that we were hearing. For instance,
hold on, real quick.
I wonder what Ella's favorite scene was to do with Haley. Oh, season two, episode one. Boo, 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 boo.
Goodness. Oh, hold on. Just another quick shout out, real quick. Shout out to Luca, who kicked everyone's ass. In trivia, shout out to Luca. Nice. Goodness, he whooped everybody.
That looked really fun.
Oh, it was so great. It was so great. Ella dropped so many nuggets.
Well, share some. What's a? Do you remember any nuggets?
Yes. So, personally, my favorite nugget that she dropped was that Anna Baryshnikov improvised the entire knitted pod scene.
Oh,
those lines were. I was thinking the whole time, like, we're going to dive into this. We're going to dissect her monologue. Like, oh, these lines were purposeful, which I believe they were purposeful, right? But she improvised those lines. She improvised the entire scene.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that fall was real. You know, she completely fell on top of Ella Hunt, and Adrian's reaction was authentic. But like, just the fact that the monologue was all improvised, and everyone just kind of had to like, try to stay in character and not break. I can't imagine Toby when she stuck her face out and was like, "Are you my father?" Like, that was nuts. That was nuts.
Wow.
Applause for Anna Baryshnikov. Another scene that was improvised, that Ella Hunt said was improvised, was the dining room scene before the bathtub scene.
Didn't you guys know that though ahead of time? I mean, that's not something you'd usually script out, like, and then she takes a grape. I don't know.
I figured, but like, you know, you would think things were a little bit more choreographed. than they were, but like finding out that she do that Haley Steinfeld just grabbed the whole piece of cake and was like, ah.
I love that. Ella's like, I'm gonna gently put a grape in your mouth.
Right.
And then Haley's like, I'm just gonna shove this cake in your mouth.
She even said during the trivia, she was like, oh, did Haley Steinfeld do that gracefully? She was like, there was nothing graceful about that. She was like, that I was over here trying to, you know, she was like, how do you gracefully eat a big old piece of cake, right?
Oh my God. I love that. It was just great too, seeing how happy everybody was. And I put a tweet out about the fandom, which was so true. Like, there was just so much love on my timeline.
Oh, there was so much warmth. So much
pouring out. And I really feel like, you know, I was only in the Q&A and I've seen Ella and other things. I just feel like the fandom really does reflect what she puts out in the world, which is sassy, like super sassy, but also just genuine kind of goodness and an authenticity. You know, I don't feel like I'm seeing a facade when I see Ella do anything in a public way, which is...
She's such a ray of sunshine. Like, honestly, the whole like trivia room, like literally, like she was laughing, cracking jokes. Like, I was just like, it was so nice to see and so refreshing. Yeah. Like, she was so friendly to everyone. Also, I just want to talk about Alfie and Simon. Cutest cats I've ever seen in my life.
When they were fighting,
yeah, and they were, kept like, showing each other.
You know, when she panned her laptop down, or I guess it was her phone. I didn't realize what her outfit looked like. And I was like, does she have saran wrap on her pants? Because she talked about the button not working. And I was like, that's an interesting choice, a styling choice to have.
She had some foil trousers.
Her stylist has been rocking it.
No, I love that outfit. That outfit was bold, but not like over the top. It looked very like well put together. She looked great. She gives me, every time I see her, she just gives me this like old Hollywood vibe. And I love it.
Yeah. Her stylist is Sarah Slutsky. Jess, any takeaways for you?
Well, I thought Courtney's questions were interesting.
They were lit.
So what were they again?
The first one was, what was one of the first roles you auditioned for?
Oh, yeah.
And Ella Hunt said Game of Thrones. She auditioned for either Arya or Sansa. And she was like in the middle of both age ranges, I guess.
Yeah.
And then I think, what was the second one? Wasn't it...
It was about the cookie,
like what? Eating. Yeah, if you could have whatever snack. I don't know if it was like for the rest of your life or like, I don't know. I just know it was about a snack and Ella Hunt pulled out a ginormous cookie the size of my dome.
Yeah, it looks so good though. You guys remember where it came from? The cookie?
Daily Provisions?
Daily Provisions.
Yep. It just looks so ginormous. I wonder if it was a chocolate chip cookie. That's my favorite type of cookie.
Yeah, real chunky too.
She said she needed it. I hope she ate more than just a cookie because she needed to be bouncing off the walls for that because that was a long day for her. I know.
That was a long day. Well, I thought it was great. And again, I thought it was very telling that people were tweeting that they were waiting a little bit longer because Ella was engaging so much with people in their three-on-ones and their one-on-ones that she was like, can I have a little bit more time? Like Ella asking to have a little bit more time with each of her fans. Like, I think that's awesome. Super awesome. Super excited to hear whatever it is she's working on this summer that she's never done before. We've all been kind of wondering about it. So I thought theater maybe because she's done a lot of different things. Or could it be a tent pole? Could it be like a big blockbuster movie? She's never done one of those. I don't know. What do you guys think? What are your predictions? What is Ella Hunt doing this summer?
I can see her in anything, honestly. Like I don't know why I thought to myself, like, I would love to see her on Broadway.
Why not? Or in a musical. Yeah.
Or in a musical. Yeah.
She's like been in a musical.
You know.
She's been in a musical.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think she's done stage. Stage is a whole nother beast. Like, it'd be great to see her stretch her wings in that.
No, but even if it wasn't like on stage, if it was like musical, like, I don't know, like In the Heights type, like a movie style musical, but full production, like that would be incredible.
So one of my favorite books of all time is The Night Circus. And I read it once a year during Christmas. It's like magical realism. It's amazing about these two magicians in the broadest sense of the term, that are sort of pitted against each other, but it is one of the most beautiful and rich books that I've ever read. And so Celia, she would be so good for Celia. And it's in development. So Ella, if you're listening, have your agents, go to Lionsgate and tell them that you should audition for it. But yeah, I think she would be phenomenal in that. Have you ever heard of the book?
No, but now that I hear that you've read it like every single year.
I don't want to give away too much, but it is so rich. I mean, I'm a very visual person. It is so rich in detail, an amazing character. Celia herself isn't involved in like a queer relationship, but there was a queer relationship in it, but it's just so transporting. Like, it's like you just go to a different world, and it's so good.
I like books like that.
Every time I read it, and there's one specific part, every time I read it, I'm catching something new, and I've read it for 5 years straight. It's just magical. I mean, that's
like me rereading The Hunger Games all over.
Yeah.
I do that too.
Yeah. It's a really good book. All right. Anything else before we wrap up?
Elena, don't leave Twitter.
Elena, I don't know if you listen to this podcast, but it's just been such a joy seeing you back on Twitter. So if you are listening, thank you.
Mama Bird, we love you.
And Anna's back on too, right?
Yes, but I haven't seen her tweet anything.
No, she's been doing the Instagram, right?
Yeah, I love her on Instagram. I love her everywhere.
Coming up, award season. So we're in the middle of award season, and we do have the GLAAD Awards, right? The show is nominated for a GLAAD Award. So excited about that. And Emmys haven't really started up yet, but as you could probably see from my tweets, I was like, well, this is a good weekend to start. So hopefully the show will get some Emmy love. What an amazing ensemble, right?
God.
So good. You know, I feel like there's casting, and then there's, you know, there's chemistry, and then there's also just the trust with this cast.
I just really want to talk about how special, like, how, I don't want to say how lucky they got with Hailee Steinfeld being an executive producer, but she cared so much about this show. And like, I remember when we first started this podcast, I was like, it'd be nice to dive in to see how deep she really was into being that executive producer role, right?
Yeah.
Because I mean, like we've said before, like whenever you're an actor, you just get that title. It's just a title. Most people don't really do much with it, but we saw how much, like, in the behind the scenes, like, footage, just how deeply she was involved.
So I think a lead character can set a tone on a set, right? When she brought the shots down and she's like, hey, you guys, part of what producers do is set the tone for everybody and keep everybody up, right? Because there's 15, 16 hour days and TV is relentless because films are really short now, right? I mean, the big ones can go on for 3 months, but like TV is like boom, 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 because you're doing so many episodes. So like to see her bring the Hailee effect, right? I thought that was so telling.
You said films are very short, and I'm just remembering sitting through 3 hours of The Batman.
No, well, I mean, the shoots are a lot, unless you're doing a franchise
or blockbuster. Yeah.
They don't go on for 3 and 4 months anymore. Like the big ones do, obviously, but like TV is a much different beast, because if you look at it, they're shooting, I mean, how many hours of content were they shooting for that mm-hmm. season? Out of content, you know, out of order. And the only other thing I was going to say about the Hailee effect was, I know Ella talked about how, you know, they really worked on and succeeded, in my opinion, about always making sure that they were moving kind of the needle on the relationship. Like, what haven't we shown before? What are we doing? And I feel like you can feel that. And I feel like, I feel like the best acting, not to, you know, and who am I to judge, but from a director brain, I feel like with Ella, her acting with Hailee was always elevated. And I think part of that is, again, chemistry is part of it, but also the trust that it sounds like they built to be able to go into these areas that maybe neither one of them had gone, and to get that intimate, and like you could just see it.
I do feel like everyone on the cast, or everyone that Hailee has worked with, anytime they have a scene with her or they're working with her, I feel like they're elevated. I think Hailee is just that type of actress, that type of her work ethic and just the attention to detail.
I also will go another step, in my opinion, and say that I think the best work that Hailee did was also with Sue. And I think mm-hmm. she's a phenomenal actress, and I feel like she's grounded all the time. I don't think I can pinpoint one time where I was like, where I didn't believe, completely believe what Haley was doing. Like, I didn't see the acting seams, right? But really on the rewatch, I've been watching, and I think that there is just this extra thing between two people who are taking risks with each other. And if you have, I don't know, I feel like they really elevated each other as well.
I want to just highlight, like, not just that, but like the risks that Elena Smith and the team were willing to allow their actors to take, like letting Anna Baryshnikov improvise a scene like that and giving her full reins, and they're like, just go nuts, right?
Yeah.
The trust that you have in your team, the trust that you have in your actors, that's next level. Like, that's how you create amazing content. That's how you create an amazing show.
Well, I think it says a lot about Elena, that Elena was the one who created this beautiful bottle that was able to capture all this gold, all this talent. So, and that's why we love Dickinson.
Just a quick little message. We want to say thank you for listening to us. And you can follow us on our podcast Twitter @4evermore, capital POD. And you can follow us on Instagram @dickinson.forevermore.podcast.
That's right. And you can hear this podcast on Spotify or wherever else that you listen to podcasts.
Well, you guys, dare I say this has been one of my favorite episodes that we've done so far?
This one?
Kind of, yeah. This one?
I think so.
I don't know. I just love you guys.
I love you too.
Of course,
James.
James loves us too.
James, wait, let me unblur. Will you say hi to my friends? We just love each other so much. We just kept talking. That's what podcasts do.
Well, let's watch Onward.